So a couple of just housekeeping things that go along with this. Number one is that the originally distributed list for the shiur included a class on April 3rd. So we will not have the class that's on April 3rd. There will be a pre-Pesach program going on over at the Thornhill Community Shul for anyone who wants to make sure they don't miss a shiur for that morning. But that evening, God willing, at Shari Shemayim, we'll be having a panel discussion on the brain death controversy and various issues that relate to it. Hopefully there will be a flyer out soon about it. I'll send the flyer also specifically to this list to make sure that you see it. But that will be at Shari Shemayim on Sunday evening, April 3rd. Also, Rabbi Dr. David Pelkovitz is going to be in the area on March 31st. He'll be speaking at the Mammon Home. That's the evening, I think it's a Thursday, March 31st. But the fact that April 3rd is not a medical halacha shiur raised a certain question, because I ended up having to divide up this shiur into two parts. What happened was I sent out the vignettes on whatever it was, Wednesday. And as I kept on looking through the material that I had and realizing, well, there's this angle, there's that angle, there's another angle that I need to bring out, I realized it was way too much to do in one shiur. And whereas in the past I haven't been shy about taking what could have been and should have been a 45-minute shiur and sort of turning it into an hour and maybe then some, this would have had us here all morning, literally. And so I split it into two. So the question is, do we want to wait for part two until May, or do we want to schedule a Sunday before then? And I don't know the answer to that. I mean, to a certain extent, Pesach is going to dictate some things, but we have to figure that out, and I welcome feedback after this year about how to handle that. The two parts really do stand alone, and the second time I'm going to also revisit what we did this time briefly, so that it's not as though it'll be a complete loss if it's held in 2 months. But you'll see as we get into the topic, there's just so much here, and I didn't want to either hold you all morning or do the topics injustice. So, with that in mind, let's get started on the topic of confidentiality of patient information. As always, ask a Rav with practical questions that come up. Ask the Rav of the Shul specifically to deal with practical questions. And one thank you also. Rabbi Dr. Eddie Reichman was in town last week, and I mentioned him. I was dealing with the topic, so he sent me two recent articles that I had not seen, and that were helpful in this regard. Okay. The issue of confidentiality of patient information within halacha really fits under the general rubric of what we call rechilus, the prohibition against talebearing, conveying information from one party to another about someone's specific situation. Within secular law and secular ethics, it tends to be treated as a special category because of the unique aspects of the doctor-patient relationship, because of the need for the patient to reveal things to the doctor that he wouldn't want anybody else to know, but he needs to for his health, because of the need for society's sake, for physicians to be able to trust that their patients are giving them complete information, and for patients to be able to trust the physician. So from a secular standpoint, it really is given unique standing, whereas within halacha, it's basically viewed as being under this general issue of rechilus, of talebearing, with the understanding that health concerns may create unique conditions that need to be considered on a case-by-case basis. So if you take a look at your sheet, I brought two psukim first. These are the psukim which start the whole issue of confidentiality. One, the pasuk says, "Lo selech rachil be'amecha, lo samod al dam reyecha, ani Hashem," from Parshas Kedoshim. You shall not walk as a peddler, literally, among your nation. The second half of the pasuk we'll get to a little bit later. Don't stand by your brother's blood. I am Hashem. So the pasuk tells us not to be a peddler, and the Gemara is going to explain that peddling doesn't simply mean don't be a peddler. If you'd said to Jews, don't be peddlers, it would have meant there were an awful lot of out-of-work Jews over the centuries. But what he's saying is not to peddle stories from one person to another, to go from one person to another, telling stories about others.
In your nation.
In your nation, correct. Will that just be for Jews? Potentially, yes. Potentially, yes. We'll have to see more about it, but potentially, yes. The second source base in Mishle, Rivcha Rives Reyecha, you may get into a fight with your Reya, with your friend, Vesod Acher Al Tagal, but don't reveal the secrets of others. And there it doesn't seem to be tied to Re'acha, it's Sod Acher. The secrets of others in general should not be revealed. Even if you're in a fight with somebody, you're in a quarrel with somebody, don't start spilling secrets of others as an attempt to gain the upper hand within the quarrel. And those are two psukim that are cited in the Gemara when they talk about the Isser, the prohibition of Rechilus against tail-bearing. The Gemara amplifies this in talking about tail-bearing. If you take a look at source Gimel, this is a classic, and I bring it in particular because it was yesterday's Parsha. Minayin la'omer davar l'chavero shehu bebal yomar ad sheyomar lo leich emor. This is a statement in the Gemara which I always wish more people knew. There are an awful lot of people who learn Yoma, but yet this doesn't seem to get any traction. He says, if a person tells you something, you are under a specific prohibition against retelling it until that person says, go tell it. Usually our default assumption is I can tell unless someone says, don't say that. But in fact, it's not true. It's just the opposite. A person is prohibited from telling unless the person says, you can tell. How do I know that? Shenemar, because the pasuk said, it was in yesterday's parsha, Vayedaber Hashem Elav me ohel moed lemor. Hashem spoke to Moshe from the ohel moed and told him, go say this. From the fact that Hashem has to tell Moshe, go tell the Jews this, that must mean that the default assumption is, you can't tell it. Hashem speaks to you, you're not supposed to say it to anybody else. And so too, anytime you are given information, you're not supposed to repeat it. And that's the default.
What kind of information are you?
Any, according to this, any information. Having nothing to do with...
The thing is, it's a shir tonight. You can't do these. Tell anybody else.
Right, so in practice, we tend to differentiate between personal information and communal information. It's certainly communal information that's readily accessible, that everybody knows. But on the face of it, yeah. You give me information, I'm not allowed to retell it. The standard that we're going to see in the Chafetz Chaim is that there has to be some kind of benefit to the other party, where that party needs to know this, and therefore the retelling is germane. Not just germane, but significant. If you take a look at source Dalet, you find another key passage on this, and it's particularly relevant for us in our discussions, as we'll see. Amar le Abaye le Rav Dimi. Abaye says to Rav Dimi, "Hai krav ma'arav amaymok misulei riv chariv es reyacha v'sod acher al tegal." Rav Dimi, remember, traveled from Israel to Bavel, and he conveys the message to he conveys various messages to people in Bavel about what they're learning in Israel. So Abaye asks Rav Dimi the following sentence: What do you do with this sentence? What do you do with this passage in Israel? And he quotes the pasuk we read from Mishlei, not to reveal secrets. So in Israel, apparently, they taught the following lesson. And the parentheses are what I added. God says to Yechezkel, go tell the Jews, your father was an Amorite and your mother was a Hittite. It's a reference to Terach and his family, saying, your ancestors were Canaanim. You come from lineage that is not going to be respected. Amra Ruach Pisconis, which is Gavriel, Lifnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu, an angel says to God, Ribono Shel Olam, Master of the Universe, Im Yavo Avram V'Sara V'Yamdu L'Fanecha Ata Omer Lehem U'Machlim Osam. If Avram and Sara were to stand in front of you, would you still say this? Would you insult their ancestors in front of them? Would you insult them saying, I'm going to reveal this element of your ancestry? And the reason this is relevant for us is they label revelation of one's ancestry as rechilus, as tail-bearing. And one of the issues that we need to discuss, we'll discuss it partially today, more in part two, is the issue of revealing information when there's a shidduch, for example, about someone's family history. Revealing something that may be considered negative about one's family history. It's labeled here as rechilus. Rivcha rives reyacha v'sodacher al tegal. You're not allowed to reveal secrets. So, based on what we've seen so far, we have these two sentences here, in Aleph and Beis, that warn us not to pass along tales. We have the Gemara in Source Gimel saying, when someone tells you something, don't reveal it. You have Source Dalet as well, which indicates that revealing information about one's family history is also under Rechilus. And then finally, Hay. And Source Hay is the one that's really going to hit home in this discussion. The Gemara talks about yichus, about lineage issues, and it mentions specifically the case of a non-Jewish man who lives with a Jewish woman, and they have a child, and that child's ability to marry a Jew. Does that child have any sort of inferior standing in marrying a Jew? And one position in the Gemara, which I think is the dominant position, is no, the child is kosher, the child is able to marry just like anybody else, and because the mother is Jewish, that child is a full-fledged Jew. There's no mamzerus attached. There's some debate. Is there something called pigam, such that he shouldn't marry into a family of Kohanim? That's a related point that we'll get to in part two. But on this point, look at what happens in this story. Av Rav Yehuda Mora Bala Hetera. Rav Yehuda, as well as several other sages mentioned there in the Gemara, ruled to say that this person can marry another Jew without a problem. Dechi asal kamed Rav Yehuda, because the following story happened. Someone came to Rav Yehuda who had this situation. His father was not Jewish, his mother was Jewish. Amar Lei, and Rav Yehuda told him, Zil Itmar, go hide. Meaning, hide your identity. Don't tell people about your parental history. Oh, Nisib Basminach, or just marry a woman who's in the same situation you are. That's the alternative. V'chiyasla kamei derava amarle ogli, oh Nisib Basminach. And when a case came to Rava, a similar story, Rava also said, either gali, meaning go into galut, go into exile where nobody knows you, oh Nisib Basminach, or marry somebody who's in the same situation you are, indicating that it's alright to hide this information. Even though the person you're marrying might I would have liked to know that before marrying. Apparently, it's okay to conceal this information and not reveal it. And Rabbi Yehuda doesn't say immediately, I better go tell people about this person's status. So these first sources are sources that seem to argue on behalf of keeping confidentiality and not conveying information to others. On the other hand, we're about to see five more sources that seem to indicate that one should tell, that in fact we are supposed to tell. After we finish these sources, what we'll do is we'll go back to the vignettes, and then we'll start talking through the vignettes, and I'll explain why I divided them up this way. We'll get to that as well. Everyone with me so far? So far, so good? Okay. It's just a lost hour of sleep that everyone's quieter this morning. The source Vav. Source Vav introduces us to a very important principle. We already saw it referenced in source Aleph as well. But Minayin Laroa es Chavero Shu Toveya Benahar, O Chaya Gorarto, O Listin Boyin Olav, Shu Chayav Lahatzilo. How do I know that there's actually a biblical obligation that if I see somebody drowning in a river, being dragged by a wild animal, or attacked by robbers, that I'm obligated to save him? Talmud Lomar, the Pasuk says, Lo Samod Al Dam Reyecha, don't stand by your neighbor's blood. You have to intervene in order to save that person. This comes up in the discussion about confidentiality, because if I know that someone is about to enter into a relationship with someone, and there's information that they do need to know, and I don't tell them, I am now violating Lo Samod Al Dam Reyecha, potentially. Or the obvious case, it's already in the first vignette listed, the case in which I discover that somebody is HIV positive and I don't inform his wife, on the face of it, it would seem I'm in violation of Lo Samod Al Dam Reyecha, don't stand by your brother's blood. But we have to talk about that. We have to talk about the extent. It's never that simple. But that's one reason that I would think to tell. Another reason to tell is the issue of Lifnei Iver. Lifnei Iver means don't put a stumbling block in front of the blind. Take a look at what the Sifra, the Medrash on Sefer Vayikra, does with that pasuk. Source Zion. V'lifnei iver lo sitein michshol. Don't put a stumbling block in front of the blind. Lifnei suma bedavar. Before somebody who is blind in a certain matter. In other words, it doesn't mean literally only don't put a stumbling block in front of the blind. I would hope that will be understood. But also, if someone is blind in a certain matter, don't cause that person to stumble. So, Bava Amar Lach, a person comes and says to you, Bas Ish Ploni Mahi Lekahuna, daughter of a certain man, I want to know, can she marry a Kohen? He's a Kohen, he'd like to go out with her, he wants to know, can she marry a Kohen or not? Al Tomar Lo Kshera Vihi Eina El Apsula. Don't tell him, oh yeah, she can marry a Kohen, and in fact you know it's not so. A person asks you for advice. Al titen lo eitza she'ena hogenes lo. Don't give him advice that's inappropriate. Al tomar lo tse b'hashkama she'kapchuhu listim. Don't tell him go out early in the morning when he's going to get attacked by bandits. Tse b'tzarayim b'shvil she'yishtarev. Don't tell him to go out in the noon if he's going to get hit with a heat wave, a sharav. At that point, Al Tomala Machora Sadacha Vakachlacha Chamor Vaata Okef Alav Vinolami Menu. Don't tell him sell your field or buy a donkey when in fact your desire is to sell his, you want to buy his field, and that's why you're telling him go sell your field to buy a donkey. Shema Tomar Eitza Tova Ninosi Lo Varea Davar Masru Lev. Even if you're going to say, you know what I'm giving him is good advice for him, and who's going to know any better? Shnemar Viresame Alokecha Ani Hashem. The pasuk says, be afraid of God. Be in awe of God. God knows whether you're sincere or not, whether you stand to benefit from the advice that you're giving him. So let me ask you a question about Tzor Zayin. Let's see if we can get a little bit of discussion going about this. This issue of Lifnei Iver, where he says, don't put a stumbling block in front of the blind. Don't give a person bad advice. Do you see any limitations on this that might be relevant to a physician in terms of not conveying information? In other words, from this, it sounds like I am required to convey information to others to keep them from stumbling. But what limitations might you see based on this passage? Yeah. What limitation would you see?
Is that if you stand to gain from giving them medical advice,
certainly the second half sounds like it's about where you stand to gain by giving the bad advice. But what else? Yeah.
It doesn't say you have to give information for free. So if someone comes and asks you a question, then you have to.
Right. The cases that are given here are where somebody comes to you and asks you something, right? What if I have information, but I wasn't asked? I know things because he's my patient. Am I able to go volunteer that information to somebody else? So that's another consideration. We have to distinguish between volunteering information and being asked. More than that, another issue that comes up is a general obligation to testify in court. Source Ches. Amar le'edim bo'u v'ha'iduni. What if somebody tells witnesses, I want you to come testify on my behalf in court, and they say, shavua shaloni idach, they swear not to testify. Nishba levatel es ha-mitzvah, or somebody swears, I'm not going to do a mitzvah. Shalalasa sukkah v'shalalito lulav v'shalaniach tefillin. I'm not going to make a sukkah. I'm not going to pick up a lulav. I'm not going to wear tefillin. Zoi shavuas shav. That's an oath in vain. And the Gemara explains, you can't take an oath not to do a mitzvah. And I have a biblical mitzvah of testifying in court. So therefore, if I take an oath that says I'm not going to testify, the oath is irrelevant. I'm liable for taking a vain oath. In fact, why is this relevant for the physician? Because the physician takes an oath, right? You don't take an oath? Really? No kidding. Is that true in general? No one's taking oaths anymore? It was optional. Wow. So wait a minute. When I go to the doctor, I should know to ask the doctor, have you taken the Hippocratic Oath?
Well, we can't take the Hippocratic Oath anyway. No problem.
Right. That's very interesting. The there are a whole bunch of different versions of the oath around. In Israel, they have a version of the oath that's separate. There's the oath of Asaf. I was going to bring them on the sheet, but in the end decided it was long enough. But if you want, I can give you an article by Avram Steinberg in Asia, where he actually goes through a whole bunch of oaths and basically shows that confidentiality is a consistent theme within these oaths. So it doesn't really matter which oath it is. Or for that matter, I'll give you one of the cases that came up in my research on this. There was a girl who was born with extreme problems in terms of genitalia, and she required reconstructive surgery just that she would be able to have relations with her husband, let alone be able to have kids. She couldn't have kids. They constructed a basic system for her, but there was no way she'd be able to have children, and she actually demanded of the physicians involved that they not reveal the information because she wanted to be able to get married to somebody, and she was concerned that he wouldn't marry her under those circumstances. And the physician said, I promise. And the question now is, number one, is this information he should be divulging? And number two, separate from that, is he permitted to divulge the information because he promised that he wouldn't? So it comes up, this issue of obligation, there it's not necessarily testimony. It's not testimony in court in that discussion. I have other cases which are, as we'll see. But you have a mitzvah of testifying. If you take an oath not to testify, is that oath binding? And then we get to the second side and source tests.
Because we're not going to discuss the patient responsibility in these matters. I mean, all of this assuming that,
So we will. We're going to talk about the patient also. More when we get to the shidduch cases. But yes, we will talk about that. Okay. Source test, the ninth source, deals with another reason to tell. And then I'm going to sum up and we'll go back to the vignettes and try to start applying these things. Source test says, Lo sonu ishes amiso, the Torah says. You shall not literally oppress another. You shall not cause another to suffer. So, ba'anaz devar makasim medaber. The Gemara takes it as a given that that's talking about verbally oppressing somebody else. Ata omer ba'anaz devar mo'eno ela ba'anaz mamon. Maybe not. Maybe it's just talking about through fraud, through cheating somebody else. And so they conclude, no, it's verbal, because I have separate psukim about that's financial. Kishu omer v'chisim grumim karla misecha o kanom yada misecha. The pasuk says, if you sell something to your friend or you buy something from your friend, al tonu ishes achiv, do not oppress, do not cause harm, do not cause suffering. Haray ona as mamon, that already took care of financial ona. Hamani mekayim lo sanu ishes amiso banaz devarim lo sanu ishes amiso is talking about verbal oppression. So from here we understand that there is a prohibition against causing others to suffer. That can come up in a lot of these cases, such as the shidduch case I just mentioned, where you could argue if the man marries her, he's not going to suffer a loss of any physical kind by marrying her. He's not endangered by marrying her. He doesn't suffer even a financial loss. But on the other hand, you could argue he would have wanted to know this, and this really would have affected his decision to marry her. And maybe it's under onas devarim. Maybe it's under some form of causing him to suffer. And then finally, the issue of genevas das, cheating somebody else. If you take a look at source Yud, Amar Shmuel says, Asur lignov das habrios, you are not allowed literally to steal the minds of others, to cheat other people. And he says, I'm not going to distinguish here Jew or non-Jew. The reason he needs to say that is because, first of all, some of the psukim that we've referenced, say Re'echa or Amisecha, which are terms that are often used to refer to others from your nation, other Jews. And number two, because in issues of commerce, there are sometimes ways in which we are told, go above and beyond for your family, even beyond what you would do for people in general. So therefore, he tells you, when it comes to defrauding others, we do not distinguish. It doesn't matter, Jew or non-Jew, you're not allowed to commit fraud. So what we've seen here is, on the one hand, several sources that mandate confidentiality and seem to license a person to keep a secret, including what would seem to be relevant information about his yichus, about his genealogy. On the other hand, we've seen mandates to inform others. We see lo samor al dam reyecha, don't stand by your brother's blood. We see lifnei iver, don't cause somebody to stumble. We see the obligation, the mitzvah of testifying. We see a prohibition against onah, causing others to suffer financially or verbally. And we see a prohibition against genevas das, against revealing secrets. So we really have a tension in halacha, balancing confidentiality versus other concerns. Which brings me back to the vignettes that I had to alter from the ones that were sent out on Wednesday. These are all variations on the first vignette that I had sent out. The ones about protection of society. We'll go through them one by one. Albert, a family physician, runs a routine blood test on his 40-year-old patient, Jason, and discovers that he is HIV positive. Albert urges Jason to inform his wife immediately. If Jason is reluctant, is Albert obligated to inform Jason's wife? So this, as was emailed back to me after I gave it out, seems to be the most obvious of cases. What would you say? Sorry?
Tell her.
Why?
Lo samor al dam
reyecha, right? That would seem to be the rule that I should help. Let me throw in though one question, which we're going to have to see a little bit about. Let's alter the vignette slightly. Let's say Jason doesn't know. Let's say you know something about Jason's condition and Jason isn't aware.
Yeah.
Or won't be aware.
You're not going to tell
You're not going to tell him. There's a case that came up in the 50s. It was asked of Mordechai Yaakov Breisch, the Chelkas Yaakov in Switzerland, where the practice at the time, certainly in Switzerland, but I think it was also the practice in North America, was often that if a patient had terminal cancer, they wouldn't tell the patient. They were concerned about damaging his health further. They wouldn't even tell the family necessarily, and that's the case he outlines. He says a doctor came to him and said, I have a patient, young man, he's 20 years old, he's engaged to get married, and I know he has terminal cancer. He has maybe a year, maybe 2 years to live, and that's it. Do I tell the girl he's engaged to? He doesn't know. His family doesn't know. She's going to marry him. He says, I know the patient is going to be in for radiation treatment. You know, he's not going to be able to impregnate her, and if he can, there's a chance of problems for the fetus. Do you inform the girl? Knowing that he doesn't even know, he is theoretically causing this situation for her. He is a threat to her, but he isn't even aware that he's a threat. So how does that play into this case? That's case number one. Okay? It is certainly the most extreme, and it's certainly the one that yields the most obvious reaction of course you have to tell. But take a look at the second one, which I think of as 1B. Brenda, a family physician, for those who haven't figured out yet the way I do my vignettes, it's just A, B, C for the names. They alter genders, and all the patients tend to be something starting with a J. It's just meant to be a neutral system. That's all it is. So anybody who happens to be named Albert or Brenda or Charles, please don't be offended. Brenda, a family physician, saw her patient Jane at a routine checkup last year, at which time Jane complained of chronic neck discomfort. An MRI showed that Jane had a herniated disc, which Jane chose to manage with a traction pillow. Subsequently, Jane was struck by an automobile, and Jane is suing the driver for damage to her neck. The driver subpoenas Brenda to testify regarding Jane's pre-accident health. Is Brenda permitted, or perhaps obligated, to testify? What if Brenda was not subpoenaed, but heard about the case? Is she obligated to testify? Now what do you do? If you're subpoenaed, you have to go. What if you refuse on religious grounds? Is there a reason to have to do that? Sorry? What happens to you if you refuse on religious grounds?
You get thrown in jail.
So here's my question. Is a person obligated to go to those lengths in terms of the prohibition of rechilus? Is a person obligated to go to those lengths? I'm going to ask the question later, and on the flip side, what if halacha says tell, and the law says don't tell?
But we can't cheat somebody else.
Correct.
Cheating the wrong party, the insurance company.
Right.
So we're not allowed to.
But that's
fraud, Gentile or Jew.
Correct.
So I think that we have to. I don't think you can hide behind this religious shield.
Well, I'm not sure that you're actually committing any fraud. Brenda's committing a fraud. What you're doing is saying, I know something, but I'm not able to tell.
Still part of this stuff. Cheating.
Is it?
Yeah.
Why?
Because my understanding is it's still part of Lo Samod.
You're not gaining... Lo Samod, yes, but the cheating thing. Lo Samod, potentially, but cheating it's not, I think, because I'm not gaining anything. And I'm not telling someone something that's untrue. I'm saying I have a black box that contains testimony and I can't tell you what's in it. It may well be Lo Samod Al Dam Reyecha, but we have to discuss the limits of Lo Samod Al Dam Reyecha. Because the another piece of this, which we still have to discuss, is whether Lo Samod Al Dam Reyecha, not standing by your brother's blood, applies it to financial harm. Maybe that's not called the blood of your brother. Maybe blood of your brother means blood. Maybe it doesn't mean somebody's financial harm at all. Well, that's why we have a shear. But also, what if you weren't subpoenaed, but you know this is your patient, and you read about the story, you heard about it in shul or whatever it is, and you know full well that Brenda is suing the driver inappropriately, because you know that there's a history that she's not divulging. No one knew. No one subpoenaed you. Why? The lawyer wasn't up on it and didn't think to subpoena you. Do you have an obligation now to make your information known? Not so simple. No obligation? Maybe.
Or a complication, because is every herniated disc surgically remediable?
Right.
Does it require surgery in every instance?
Right.
And is it perhaps more common today than it used to be to treat it conservatively and therefore the accident actually did loosen her sufficiently, and therefore it is legitimate for her to sue. But right. That's
so in other words, you don't know that your information is relevant.
Right.
Correct. Yes. Right. So again, you don't know that your information really should be a deciding factor at all. You don't know one way or the other.
In pretty much all accidents like this, the doctor is actually always contacted and often has to show previous records.
Yeah. That's kind of what I figured. I kind of figured that they would be subpoenaed. But I asked the question because as a theoretical question in general, am I obligated to volunteer testimony, I think is an interesting question.
Is always an OHIP release. There's always a release. The patient signs a release.
That's right.
To get all the information from OHIP. So if I did see somebody once, right. I will always get a letter for that.
What if they saw you without charging it to the insurance? Yes, that's a really theoretical case.
Certainly not me.
Yes. You were a problem. You don't show up.
Right. I mean, we can come up with it. We can come up with a case, but I think the principle is really the big question. Am I obligated to volunteer testimony? And then the third case, which hadn't even dawned on me until I saw it discussed in the Tzitz Eliezer. Charles, a neurologist, routinely teaches his students during hospital rounds at the bedside of his patients, many of whom are unconscious and unable to provide consent. I don't know, in Canadian hospitals, do you actually ask the patient for permission before doing this? They sign when they're admitted? Right, but if they come in through the ER and they're unconscious, they were in a car accident and they...
Somebody signs it for them. Mm-hmm. There is an essential admission.
Okay.
What about on examination?
You're supposed to get consent for examination.
In any case, unconscious.
The ambulance brings somebody.
Hang on, multiple issues. In an emergency situation, you have permission to examine, period, because it's an emergency situation trying to define what's going on. Once you're admitted, you've signed a consent in this province to be admitted if it's a teaching hospital for all the different people learning to participate in your care. But for the individual element of being examined, by student A, B, C, or D, we insist every student says, I am so-and-so, may I talk with you and examine you?
Okay. In this case, it's not going to happen because the patient's not conscious. No one's actually going to be saying that. I bring it here more because the Tzitz Eliezer discusses it, and you'll see it's not going to be a major piece to this, but it was an interesting one to put here. Is he permitted to share the details of his patient's conditions without their consent? Let's say there is no consent. Let's say there is no release for whatever reason. Are you in fact able to share that, or do we argue that that's rechilus as well? That's tail-bearing. So let's go through some sources and see what we can learn here. Canadian law itself seems to vary by province. I gave you a link there for some information, as well as a very interesting paper on the history of Ontario legislation. What I assume all of you are familiar with is the Personal Health Information Protection Act, which seems to be the governing statute, which on the one hand provides law, but on the other hand leaves everything very vague. It really cops out on some of the major questions. As we'll see, and it says basically leave it to the courts. Am I right that that's what is currently governing? I couldn't find anything more recent than that, and I found plenty of cases that referred to it. That's why I was assuming that that's the currently governing statute.
Where it doesn't fit, it defaults to the national legislation, which is called the
PETA. Right. The problem is this seems to based on what I saw, this seems to cover the cases that we're talking about. Tell me if at some point it doesn't.
And also the report of the disease Mm-hmm. HIV would fall under that.
Yes.
And it's a reportable disease except in certain circumstances, such as anonymous testing. So in the first case, it would probably devolve to the public health to notify any partners of anybody who's HIV positive unless they were tested anonymously.
Got it. Okay. That's good to know. Thank you. So, looking at vignette one, we have three questions that we need to ask. Number one, is rechilus, the prohibition against tail-bearing, overridden by lo samod al dam reyecha, not to stand by your brother's blood? Number two, if you swore that you weren't going to divulge, is that oath effective given that you were required to help? And number three, is that person who is dangerous considered a rodef, a pursuer, if his danger that he poses is unintentional? This is more straightforward case. The second one is going to be the one that's going to take more of our time. So the piece from this Personal Health Information Protection Act that's germane here, I brought it on your sheet, says a health information custodian may disclose personal health information about an individual if the custodian believes on reasonable grounds that the disclosure is necessary for the purpose of eliminating or reducing a significant risk of serious bodily harm to a person or group of persons. And that's the basis for the issue of revealing the contagious disease. I mean, that's what this is based on. You want to protect people. It's clear that within Canadian law, you would tell. I think that's straightforward. You would be obligated to tell. What about within halacha? So the Chafetz Chaim discusses this and says in his laws of Rechilus that you are obligated to tell. If you see source Yud Aleph, he says, "Im echad roa shechavera rotzel lihishtatev beiza davar im echad." If one sees that somebody wants to enter a partnership with somebody else, v'humishaer shebevaday yisovev lo ayedei ze inyan ra, and he gauges that because of this, the person will enter into some bad state. Tzarich la'agid lo, you have to tell him kdei latzilo min inyan arahu, to save him from that bad state. You have to save him from disaster by informing him. And the Chafetz Chaim, in the course of his discussion of this, mentions medical cases as one of his examples and says the physician is going to be obligated to inform. He does have certain rules that he provides as caveats. He says, number one, you have to contemplate whether you're sure that the harm will be caused. How sure are you this is going to happen? Number two, you can't inflate the danger when you're telling the person. Number three, you can only be motivated to help this person, not to harm the other. If, in fact, you might be motivated by some personal involvement, you should tell a third party who really isn't involved and let that third party be the one to decide whether to inform. Can the benefit be achieved only by telling the person? And also, he wants to know, might this lead to harm for the subject beyond the imminent issue? But in general, the obligation is to tell. You do have to tell. The Pesachei Tshuva, commentary on the Shulchan Aruch and Orach Chaim Kuf Nun Vav, goes on at length about this. He's very upset. He says that all the result of all the Musar Svarim that are written about not speaking Lashon Hara, not saying negative things, have resulted in an overbalancing where people now won't tell when they need to. When they need to help somebody else, they're hyper-concerned about not telling Lashon Hara and not telling Rechilus and all that, and the result is that people are being hurt because they don't know what they need to know. And he writes very strongly about this issue. The physician's oath not to convey information is not considered relevant here for reasons that we're going to come back to in the next vignette. And then lastly, what about the fact that the person who's doing the harm is not intending to do harm? And the answer seems to be it doesn't matter. The Vilna Gaon says this in a comment to Shulchan Aruch Hashem Mishpat Tav Chaf Hey. But I didn't bring that. Instead, I brought a Gemara which makes that very clear. If you take a look at Source Yud Beis, Gemara brings a story. Ha'u Gabra the Akdim Va'asek Chamra Lemavra Kamei Desliku Inshi B'Mavra. There was a guy getting on a boat, and he took his donkey onto the boat with him. Before, all the other people got on the boat. Then people got on the boat. Boy lid bue. The boat was going to sink. They go out on the river, and the boat's going to sink, and the donkey apparently is the threat. So Asahu Gavra, along came somebody, Malach Le Lechamra. Rashi gives two explanations for Malach. Either Malach means he acted as a sailor, or it means he pushed the donkey. But either way, the result is the donkey goes overboard. Lechamra du Gavra, Veshadi Lenara, pushed him into the river, Vatavan, the donkey drowned. Asla kameh de Rabba, the owner of the donkey, comes to Rabba and says, hey, he pushed my donkey overboard. Patre, Rabba says he's exempt from liability. The Amar le Abaye, Abaye says, Vamatzil atzma b'mamon chaverohu. Abaye says, why? I'm not allowed to save my own life by damaging someone else's property. Amar le, hay meikar rodef hava, to which he said, no, that person isn't that donkey is an assailant. He is a rodef. He is your pursuer. He's not some uninterested third party. He's actually the one who is attacking you, because he's there on the boat. Now, the guy brought the donkey on the boat, not intending to harm anybody. He brought him on the boat before the people were there, but he's called a pursuer anyway, despite the lack of intent or even knowledge. And we extrapolate from this and other sources. I can give you a whole bunch of other sources on this. We extrapolate from here that you are obligated to... Not you're obligated. You're considered... A person is considered a rodef, even if that's not his intent. Yes? Right.
So abortion is permitted in those cases.
Right. Correct. That's another example of it. Right. That's another example we could bring. Another example we could bring is the Ramaz ruling that if you have a Jew who is forging currency, you know about it, you are obligated to turn him over to the authorities, because he is a rodef against the community. And there are other cases that are brought up that are proof of it. He's not a rodef intentionally. He doesn't intend to get caught. But that's exactly what he's causing, because when they catch him, certainly in Krakow in the 16th century, it's going to be trouble for the entire Jewish community. Yes?
What if this person was a human being, not a donkey, perfectly obese?
Interesting. No, it's a very interesting question. It sounds like he would be able to push him overboard. That's what it sounds like. The only reason that I question that is actually one of the cases that's brought in the lengthier discussion of this issue, and that's the Sheva ben Bichri case. Sheva ben Bichri was liable for death in the days of David HaMelech, and he runs into a town, and the army besieges the town, and says, listen, hand them over, and we won't kill anybody else. And they hand them over. And the question is that precedent for saying you hand over one person who was endangering others, even where his intent was not to endanger the others? Now, if I remember correctly, in the literature on this, we say that where he is somebody like Sheva ben Bichri, who's liable for death anyway, you turn him over. But otherwise, you don't turn somebody over. On the other hand, in this case, he's a more direct rodef, because the boat is going to sink because of him. Unless you're going to argue that three people have the same weight that he does, and maybe you should throw three other people overboard. It's an interesting question. I'm not so sure, because it's not really a weight issue here as much as it's, I think, the donkey's conduct on the boat. Right, so I thought it was a weight issue when I first read it, but then I started wondering, is it really the weight? It's not so clear. It's a good question. I'm not 100% sure. Let me look into it before I answer that. I want to do my research first. Okay. So in practice, everybody rules that you have to tell. There's no one who says that you don't tell in this vignette. The Nishmas Avram quotes Shlomo Zalman Orbach in the case where a spouse is HIV positive, and he talks about the rates of infection and how sure are you that the spouse will become infected, and says, yes, you must tell. The Tzitz Eliezer discusses another case, as does Rav Avadya Yosef. The Tzitz Eliezer in Yud Gimel Pei Aleph, Part B, says that if you have a driver who is epileptic and he wants to get a driver's license, you're obligated to notify the licensing bureau. The Rav Avadya Yosef and Yechaved Das, Chilek Dalid, Tshuva Samach, says also a guy who wants a driver's license and he has an illness that's not readily visible to people, you would tell. They also discuss another issue of trusting the patient. What if the patient says, look, I won't drive at night, he has bad night vision, and I won't drive at night, so can you trust him? And the answer seems to be that the greater the risk involved, the greater the risk to society, the less likely we are to trust him. In other words, if he could cause an accident and kill people, I don't care that he promises he's not going to drive at night. We still say the ophthalmologist is required to notify the licensing bureau. Okay. This brings us to... That's already... Sorry. But this brings us into the more complex of the cases. And this is the issue of providing medical testimony, and again, despite the lack of the oath, and despite the fact that you're likely to be subpoenaed, and you have to, you know, under law, you have to testify, there's still a lot to say here. First of all, because of, well, you see the five questions that I laid out there. Does the mitzvah of testimony trump your oath? Does the mitzvah of testimony trump rechilus? Does the mitzvah of testimony apply to a single witness? And does the mitzvah of testimony require him to volunteer? And what if testifying could come back to harm the physician? These are all issues that we need to address. So, the Supreme Court in Canada actually had a very interesting case in which they decided not to disclose. The story was that a man was accused of indecent assault on a minor. And his defense demanded the release of her medical records. I don't know why that was particularly germane, but that's the case. And the court initially ruled that the records had to be released. She appealed. The appeal went all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said not to release the records. That was their position, and I gave you the link there where you can find the ruling online. But the court says you don't release the records. The Personal Health Information Protection Act cops out on this, and it says one may testify in a proceeding where the court requires it. But that doesn't give you any standard whatsoever to work from. It just says, well, the courts are going to figure it out. So the question is, what happens within halacha? We do have this idea that there is privacy, and you have to figure out at what point is my information really relevant. Like in this Supreme Court case, where they decided evidently that it wasn't relevant enough to actually require its revelation. So first of all, does the mitzvah of testimony trump the oath? You know what? I'm going to come back to that at the end, since everyone said they didn't take an oath or were required to take an oath. I'll come back to that part at the end, so that those who have to leave will be able to leave. So I'm going to come back to that last. Does the obligation to testify extend to the case where you are only one witness? You're the only witness in the case. So remember that testimony, from a halachic standpoint, is limited to two witnesses. Maybe the obligation to testify extends only to a single witness. So take a look at source Yud Zayin, please, on the last side. Amar Rabbi Yeshua. Rabbi Yeshua says, "Arba'a devarim ha'osa osan pater midine adam v'chaya bedine shemayim." There are four different behaviors for which human courts will not find you liable, but God is going to be upset, and He will find you liable. Ve'eluhen, and these are the four, and one of the four is v'hayodeya edus lachavero ve'enu meid lo. If you know testimony about somebody and you fail to testify, so the Gemara asks, "B'mayaskinan, what's your case?" Elam of a betray, if there are two witnesses, pshita, of course you have to tell. And that is actionable in court. Del Raisa, that's biblical. Imloya given asavo. Now the pasuk says, if you don't tell, you're liable for sin. Ela bechad. So it's even if it's one witness. So what he tells you is that you have not violated imloya gid if you are one witness. If you're one witness, you're actually not obligated under Jewish law to go and testify. So it appears that a lone witness would not be violating im lo yagid v'nasavo, no, if he failed to testify. So that's worth noting. Yes.
But if you were the only witness, yeah. Your testimony would work.
So here's the interesting question: what happens when I convey this over to secular courts? In a Jewish court, you're the lone witness; they'll throw it out. However, if we're dealing with a secular court, where that witness's testimony is going to be germane, then maybe this is resuscitated, and the fact that here it's not relevant doesn't matter. Maybe again your obligation to testify kicks back in, because as you said, in that case, your obligation is your testimony actually is significant.
If let's say a husband beat up his wife, and I have actually witnessed and documented all of her injuries, I am the only witness.
Right.
That wouldn't apply.
So it would, because you have documentation also. In other words, the documentation itself would be admissible. Right. Well, actually, no, I'm sorry. In the case that you are providing, it would matter in any case. And the testimony would matter. And the reason is because we distinguish between testimony about an action and testimony about a physical reality. Meaning, when it comes to testimony in court, the requirement for two witnesses, and for that matter, the male requirement for witnesses, is only about testifying about an event. I saw so-and-so shoot so-and-so. However, when it comes to testimony about a physical item, this food is kosher, or this person had such and such a wound, a single witness, man or woman, is acceptable in court. So for that matter, the case you're giving, it absolutely would be a requirement then for me to testify. So that's my understanding.
Except that that's not even in that particular case. It's at best an asmachta. It's not really, because you're not testifying that you don't have evidence that that person did it.
Right, it's circumstantial.
At most, it's a circumstantial evidence. So in halacha, it wouldn't stand.
I mean, in an extreme case, you could, at a strangulation, there are fingerprints or something like that. You could.
No, that's changing the issue. But
right.
Someone who has documented, bruises, and he says it was the husband or
correct.
That sort of thing. I mean, in halacha, that's.
Right. Right. And my tendency is to feel that many cases of testimony that we consider testimony will not fall under Im Lo Yagid. However, there's another issue here. Yes?
What's your conclusion?
My conclusion from this is that a single witness would not be obligated to testify under Im Lo Yagid
Ben
Asav.
Yes. You're
right, no, because the understanding of that set of cases that are presented there is that you're not liable under any specific pasuk. It's not as though I could point to a biblical rule saying you have to do it, but God is saying this behavior is inappropriate. It's not that you haven't violated the letter of the law, you violated the spirit of the law, is I guess the idea. This is going to carry over. And I'm going to come back to the question of what is involved if Im Lo Yagid is not, right here. But it carries over into the issue of voluntary testimony. What if you know information and it's up to you to decide whether you're going to volunteer it or not? Take a look at Yud Ches. Sefer HaChinuch writes, V'ulam, this is regarding the mitzvah of Im Lo Yagid. V'ulam chiluk yesh bein dine mamonos l'dine nefashos u'sha'ar isur in Shabbat Torah. There's a difference between financial cases and other cases. Shabbat dine mamonos ein adam chayev l'ha'id aleihem me'atzmo elim ken yitbe'enu bala davar o beisdin. When it comes to financial cases, you're not obligated to testify under Jewish law unless someone specifically says, come testify in my case. But otherwise, there is no obligation to testify. So there's no obligation, in other words, for me to volunteer testimony under Im Lo Yagid. So once you say that, once you introduce this idea that Im Lo Yagid does not include single witnesses and doesn't include voluntary testimony and perhaps doesn't include circumstantial evidence, you could argue, what obligation remains? The answer is in source Yud Tes. Yud Tes Chaf. The Shulchan Aruch rules in Suras Yates, I'm not going to read it out because I want to make sure to finish roughly on time. The Ramah writes there that a person who swears not to reveal information about somebody else has taken an oath that is not binding because he has the obligation of Im Lo Yagid. However, he says, you should get Hataras Nedarim. You should get that vow lifted. Why do I need to get that vow lifted? Because after all, he says basically your obligation to testify in this case is not considered to be explicitly biblical, and therefore your oath is somewhat binding. The Gra, commenting on that in source Chaf, explains and adds a source that would obligate me to testify. In addition to the issue of Im Lo Yagid, because the Vilna Gaon is not really talking about Im Lo Yagid here. He's talking about revealing information in general. And he says this. He says in Source Chaf, look at the Rashbam in Bava Basra, as is written in Bava Metzia, Ra'amayim v'chulu l'chol avedas. That's the way the Vilna Gaon writes. What he's referring you to is a discussion in the Gemara about a person who sees that someone else's field is about to be flooded, and his obligation to do what he can to prevent the field from being flooded or to notify the owner of the field. And the principle is that I'm obligated in returning lost objects for others. That's the biblical law. And so too, I'm obligated in general to save other people's property from damage. It's part of overall chesed, overall kindness. That's why the Ramah says your oath isn't binding. Even in a non-testimony case, even in a case that's not covered by Yom Lo Yagid, the law is that I am obligated to help others simply as a matter of chesed, as a matter of kindness to them. And therefore, even if I am a lone witness, and even if I am not subpoenaed, I have an obligation to benefit the defendant. In this case, the driver of the automobile, and therefore I have to offer testimony. That matters a great deal. Saying that it's not under Im Lo Yagid, but instead it's under Chesed, matters a great deal. Because of the case where testimony could harm me in the future. There's a very interesting discussion that comes up in Piskei Din Rabbaniyim. I can give you the reference after for those who want it. But it was a case that came up with the IDF. Doctors in the IDF see soldiers, and they have to rely on the soldiers to be honest with them about their conditions. And you need to know that. You're giving this person a gun. So there was a soldier in the IDF who had been seen by a psychiatrist, and after being discharged from the IDF, went back home to his family, and there was some case that came up involving his family and his mental health. And his wife wanted a divorce based on his mental condition and tried to get the records from the army. The army argued that if we divulge this information, then soldiers will not be honest with us on future medical exams. We are going to suffer harm if we reveal the information. Now, in this case, the Beis Din involved ruled that the testimony came from people who were not acceptable to testify in court under Jewish law. And therefore, they said, Im lo yagid would actually not be relevant. The obligation to testify is not relevant. However, gemilus chasadim, helping others, in this case helping the wife, is relevant. So the question was, but we're going to suffer harm in the future because patients are not going to reveal all their information. And they ruled that in order to override your obligation to help others, you need a clear-cut loss. Here it's only a vague concern. And on that basis, they ruled the IDF had to turn over the medical records. This has relevance for the case that I posed before about the physician who may have to go to jail for revealing the information. What if halachically I am obligated to reveal the information, but not a jail case? Forget the jail case. What if by halacha I have to reveal it, but I could lose my license for revealing that information? It's my chesed for somebody else against me losing my license. Am I obligated to do so? The answer appears to be no. The answer appears to be no. And the reason the answer appears to be no is because me losing my license is a clear and imminent danger. It's not something that may happen at some point in the future. And therefore, I would not be able to tell, assuming it was a financial loss for that person and not something greater. Because you have to balance the potential loss for the person versus your own loss. So the upshot of this vignette is that the mitzvah of testimony does trump rechilus. The mitzvah of testimony may not apply to a single witness and may not apply to somebody volunteering testimony. However, the obligation of chesed does. And the difference between saying testimony and saying chesed is that if you're going to say chesed, then you could argue it's going to hurt me, therefore I'm not obligated to testify. Therefore, I'm not obligated to volunteer the information. There is still one piece that I want to see on that, but first I want to conclude and summarize for those who have to leave before we come back to it. And that is the issue of doing rounds. Just because I found it great that he actually brought this up. In source Chavdala, the last source on the sheet, the Tzitz Eliezer, he says, "Vizoi atshuva gam l'mashe chvodo shoel od b'meskeres she'el aso." He says, in addition to what he has already said earlier, this answers another question you asked. Im yesh mishum gilui sod ba'drachas studentim liyad mitas achole. Is there an issue of revealing secrets when you bring students around on rounds? Kasher ha'matara hi limud ha'student v'lo ezra l'chole. Where the goal is the student's learning and not helping the patient. So he says two things. Number one, he says, every physician knows that he's going to be expected to do rounds at some point. And therefore he says it's not within your oath. Anybody who actually took the oath did not have this as part of what he had in mind when he took the oath. And his second point is that in fact you do learn. Remember the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos that says, "Umi tamida yose mikulam?" I learn more from my students than from anybody else. He says that's not limited to Torah. That's true in general. The physician discusses the case with the patient, with the students. The students ask questions, and by the students' questions, he can learn something that's actually going to benefit this patient. And therefore, on those grounds, he says it is actually to the benefit of the patient. He then goes on to discuss not embarrassing the patient, asking permission if possible, and all of that. But he says on that basis, you do the rounds, and it's not an issue of rechilas. I found that to be a very interesting piece. Going back to the question of the oath and whether the physician's oath is binding. There is a rule when it comes to taking a shavua, when it comes to taking an oath, that oaths do not apply to mitzvos. Like we said, a person swears, I'm not going to build a sukkah, the oath is irrelevant. What if you take an oath that's not directly against a mitzvah, but it happens to include a mitzvah? A person swears he's not going to eat matzah ever. Happens to include Pesach. But it also includes a whole bunch of other things. So the rule seems to be that oath could well be binding. It depends on a discussion in a Tosfos in Shavuos, Daf Chavdalet Amud Aleph. But in fact, we do seem to say that if you don't mention the mitzvah itself, then the oath is binding. If you take a look on your sheet at... Where did I bring this? Yes, the source Yud Gimel, the bottom of the second side. Shvur shalo ochal matzah. A person swears he's not going to eat matzah ever. Aser lechol matzah b'lel Pesach. He's not allowed to eat matzah on Pesach night. Mind you, it means he's violating a mitzvah. He's missing a chance to do a mitzvah. He should get this oath annulled. But that's the rule. He can't eat matzah. Whereas if he says, Shvur shalo ochal matzah b'lel Pesach, if he says, I won't eat matzah on Pesach night, loke, he gets lashes for taking an oath in vain, and he eats matzah. That's the distinction that we draw. So based on that, a physician takes an oath and says, I'm not going to reveal information, right? He takes that oath, that's an all-inclusive oath. It isn't specific to the case where that information is needed and halachically required. So therefore, that oath should be binding. So what do you do? So the answer seems to be that you should try to pursue Hataras Nedarim for that part of the Shavua. That's what they recommend. You should try to get that part of the vow annulled. And that's the ruling that's offered by the Shach. I brought it here in Yudalit and Tesvav. That you do it. Even though you could argue that Atara should be unnecessary because, after all, you have an obligation to testify, it's good to satisfy this issue of an all-inclusive oath by doing the Ataras Nedarim. There's so much more that I want to add to this, but I'm gonna summarize now rather than add more. There's a lot more to this theme. You can see now, I hope you understand now why I had to split this into two. There's an awful lot more here. Among the things that are included in part two, just so that you know what you're missing, among them, the question of does lo samod al dam reyecha apply to financial harm? Does it apply to emotional harm, anguish in general? That's a major question. Within a shidduch, what if there's someone who is being set up and cares about a certain factor which you don't consider to be significant? Which halacha doesn't consider to be significant. Let's say that fellow who wanted to hide his lineage, and halachically his lineage is insignificant, but you know that the girl who's going to marry him does care. So do you have an obligation to tell her? Because after all, she wants to know, is that gedevas das, by not informing her. Let's say it's not about lineage. Let's say it's a medical condition that you think she shouldn't care about, but she would care about. Then what? So these are all issues that we have to visit in part two. It's just too much information for us to do it in one part. So to summarize what we did...
Before you do, can you just go back to the vignette number two?
Yeah.
And just, in the questions there, just to sort of, and before you summarize it.
Yeah.
And just, how would you, after hearing the shir, respond to the question, is Brenda permitted or perhaps obligated to testify?
Mm-hmm.
In this case here, I mean, we've heard the issue of single witness and not being called and things like that. I mean,
right.
How does this actually bear out in this particular case?
Right. So I'm going to go through in order, but I'll make sure to address that when I do vignette number two. First, vignette number one, the issue of, well, to go back even before vignette number one, we saw confidentiality sources versus lo samod al dam reyecha, lifnei iver, im lo yagid v'nasav ano, obligations to testify, ona'a, by defrauding others or causing others to suffer, either financially or with money, and gnevas das, this issue of cheating others. I think I just said financially or with money. I meant financially or with words. We saw a very little bit about Canadian law. Moving to vignette number one in Albert, the answer seems to be he is absolutely obligated to convey the information under lo samar al dam reyecha, even though there's rechilus. Rechilus is overridden to benefit the other with the caveats of the Chafetz Chaim about how you tell, and it includes even where the person is causing the harm is not doing so intentionally, like the case of the donkey and the forger and so on. And so has been ruled by pretty much every posek who addresses this topic. The second one, the case of Brenda. So we did outline that there is a mitzvah of testimony which trumps the physician's oath. Maybe the oath is binding because it includes other cases where you're not obligated to testify. However, then you would do hatara for that specific aspect of the oath. However, the obligation to testify may not include a single witness, and if in the second part of that, if she wasn't subpoenaed to testify, may not extend to the person who wasn't subpoenaed, because it's a financial case, it's not a life and death case. However, you have a separate obligation to testify under chesed, under helping somebody, preventing someone from suffering a loss, which includes the financial loss. And therefore, Brenda, I believe, is obligated to testify, with the caveat that if testifying, and not just testifying, but if helping someone out by revealing information could cause her to lose her license, then she's not going to be obligated, because when you're doing chesed for others, you're not obligated to cause yourself more harm than the aid you provide to somebody else. That's a fundamental rule. Your own loss comes first. There actually is a separate piece that I didn't cover in this. On your sheet, you can see it. The Rambam in source Chaf Aleph, and it's really Chaf Aleph to Chaf Gimel. And basically, what that is an obligation to testify if I have a document that has contents in it that could help somebody else. That's a whole other thing. The Rambam rules that if I have a document that contains information that could help you in your case, I am obligated to reveal it. The Shulchan Aruch disagrees with the Rambam and says, no, I'm not. But that's only if I'm not the one who stands to gain. If I actually am the one, that goes back to Laser's initial question. If I am the one who actually stands to gain, right? Let's not the case of the physician who's a third party, but I am the actual party involved who's suing, then I am obligated to reveal that information. So in other words, to take it to the case of Brenda, Brenda may not be obligated to provide the information, but Jane sure is. Jane has a halachic obligation to provide that information. Finally, the issue of doing rounds with the students, it is indeed justified despite concerns for rechilus, even without consent. Any physician's oath will not cover this, because everybody knows at the time they take the oath they're going to be doing rounds. And in terms of the benefit to the patient, it does benefit the patient, because the physician may learn something through the discussion with the students. Again, there's an awful lot more to see. I apologize for not covering everything that was in the Wednesday night vignettes. God willing, we will pick up with this at some point in the future. I think our class was tentatively scheduled. The next one was to be May 15th. If there's a feeling that we should really do it sooner, I have the information set up. It's like those films that they film like the three movies in the trilogy and then they just release them a year apart. I have the information. I could do it tomorrow. The only question is in terms of finding a Sunday that works for people. I'm not even sure how to do that. So I'm going to send out an email, I think, and get feedback on whether we should try to move up the next one or just say we'll do it in May after we've cleared Pesach. We'll see. Thank you very much.